Welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm Brim Watkins. I'm pleased to bring you this podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank specialised in economics and economic policy. Today we're going to talk about non-performing loans, often known by the catchy acronym NPLs. With any loan, there is always a risk that the borrower will get into trouble repaying, but this situation has become much more common in the wake of the financial crisis and the recession that followed. In fact, European banks are now carrying around 1 trillion euros of non-performing loans. With my guests, I'll be exploring the reasons for this crisis and its impact on banks, borrowers, and the wider European economy. We'll also be talking about potential solutions. First things first, what exactly is a non-performing loan? I asked Maria Demertsis, Bruegel's Deputy Director.
A non-performing loan is a loan on the balance sheet of banks that is not paying itself back. And typically you have two things that you need to pay. You pay interest rate and you pay the original capital. A non-performing loan is a loan that is not paying itself back. So no interest and no capital.
Lending, that is providing credit to individuals, households and businesses, is at the core of a bank's activities. So if a loan isn't performing, then the bank has a problem. And if lots of loans aren't performing, the bank has a big problem. Here's Maria again.
It's a problem for banks because they actually have a number of assets on the balance sheet. The loan is an asset for the bank. And this asset, which is actually the product of the bank, is not paying. So they're not able to make profits on it. And that's why this is a problem for the bank. So it's as though they have a product that is not generating any profit.
Weak profitability is not the only risk when a bank has an excessive NPL burden. I spoke to Sharon Donnery, Deputy Governor of the Central Bank of Ireland and Chair of the NPL Task Force at the ECB's Single Supervisory Mechanism. Sharon told me about some other ways that NPLs can damage banks.
I suppose for the banks themselves, there are a couple of different dimensions. The impact first on capital, because the banks obviously have to hold capital against these impaired assets. And that can, of course, constrain their ability to do new business and lend into the economy. And finally, I suppose, from a funding perspective, because the whole debate about provisions and the valuation of collateral and so on can lead to some uncertainty for investors, this can impact on bank funding.
We'll return to the banks later and look at ways that they can reduce their NPL burden. But first, it's worth exploring why exactly this NPL crisis has become such a hot political topic. I asked Piers Harben, Director of Oversight at the European Banking Authority, why NPLs are such a problem for the European economy.
I mean, non-performing loans are what we might call a misallocation of capital. They block up the system, which means that other capital can't be used to extend loans into the real economy. Let me put it simply. If the banking system is the beating heart of the European economy, we've had a heart attack and our arteries are blocked with these NPLs.
But reducing the supply of credit is not the only way that NPLs damage economic growth. As Bruegel's Maria Demertsis explains, it is important to remember that behind every non-performing loan, there is a borrower who is struggling.
Any debt contract has got two sides. It has got the creditor, that's the bank, and it has got the debtor, which is, you know, if you have a mortgage loan, that would be a household, or if it is a corporate loan, that would be a firm, right? So any debt contract has got, like any other contract, it has got two sides, the creditor and the debtor. When you talk about NPLs, you're talking about the side of the creditor. So it is the creditor who has the loan, and then you say those loans are not performing, and why is that the problem for the bank, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, if that debt is not performing, it means that the debtor also has a problem. That's the reason why this loan is not performing, is because the debtor is not performing. By that, I mean the debtor is not paying back. Okay. Now, if you have a big number of those loans, that means there's a lot of debtors that are not paying back, which means that a lot of debtors that are in some sort of distress. And that is an issue because those people, those debtors that are not performing, they are stuck with having to service loans that don't generate enough value added to pay back the loan. Right? So it's as though they're stuck in sort of unproductive opportunities.
So an economy that has lots of NPLs is an economy with many distressed borrowers. This is a real risk for one of Europe's main motors of growth, entrepreneurship. I asked Maria about the impact of NPLs on entrepreneurship.
Take the side of a small firm, and let's suppose that this firm has borrowed in order to be able to grow, because that's what we do in Europe, we borrow to grow. And let's suppose that this firm is now unproductive. Right? You've tried something and it didn't work. What happens next, right? I mean, you have to be able to release this entrepreneur, this firm, from its debt obligations, right? This is what bankruptcy means, right? But if you go through bankruptcy procedure and this procedure doesn't allow you to sort of be freed from your debts easily, then you're going to be stuck with basically having to finance a debt for a business opportunity that has failed. That generates very wrong incentives from the point of view of the entrepreneur, because this entrepreneur now is financing an economic activity that is not productive. So there comes a point, and this is how things would help, if the institutional arrangements recognize when something is unproductive, terminate it as fast as possible, and allow this entrepreneur to perhaps try to do something else, something different that may be productive. You see, generate incentives that are going to help this person start again.
But could this unfriendly stance on debt and borrowers have cultural roots? Maria thinks it might. For example, she sees a clear difference between European and US approaches to risk, debt, and insolvency.
And I think in the US they do have that culture of appreciating risk-taking and therefore forgiving when that risk-taking goes belly up. And you can see that in various types of institutions. For example, institutions like insolvency, so what happens when you do fail, they tend to be quite penalizing for debtors in Europe, whereas in the US they're slightly more forgiving.
Now let's go back to the banks themselves. Because if NPLs are such a problem for banks and the wider economy, then banks need to do something with them. This process is often known as workout. It involves recognising that a borrower is having difficulty repaying their loan and moving the debt to another department of the bank. The bank negotiates with the borrower to try and return the loan to health, but ultimately banks often have to seize assets and recognise losses. Alexander Lehmann is a visiting fellow here at Bruegel, and he works a lot on financial regulation. I asked him what this NPL workout entails and why it is often so challenging for banks.
A workout effort is very different from the core business of the bank, which is to generate economic opportunities through additional credit provision. So it requires things like taking ownership of certain assets within the borrower, servicing or maintaining certain assets. So take the example of a large residential real estate company that goes in default, say in a country like Ireland. The bank will need to run the maintenance, fixing the windows, servicing utilities, maintaining contracts with the residents. And that's not something the bank is generally very good at, nor is it keen to do this. And therefore, banks often try and move these assets away from their balance sheets.
Regulatory and legal hurdles are another reason that workout is such a challenge for banks trying to resolve their NPLs. I asked Sharon Donnery from the Central Bank of Ireland whether Europe was making progress and what difficulties banks and lenders still face.
From a supervisory perspective, clearly, prior to the introduction of banking union, there were many different approaches to banking supervision across the euro area. And a big step in terms of the establishment of ECB banking supervision has been to coordinate supervision better. And we've recently done a significant amount of work about setting out our supervisory expectations. So in terms of how we as supervisors engage with the banks, we're telling them what we expect them to do, how we expect them to set their strategies, how we expect them to operationalise those, and how we expect them to basically manage this important issue towards a resolution. I think the other aspect then is this more national aspect, which can be related to different dimensions like judicial aspects. So we hear, for example, in a stocktake report that we've done, we see there can be delays in court, there can be inefficient processes around court capacity, for example. Another legal aspect is accessibility to out-of-court settlement. So an important element for both banks and debtors is their ability to settle their debt, but rather than going through a court-based process, to do that in an out-of-court way. And many countries don't have very good processes for that.
With all these challenges in the workout process, banks often try to get non-performing loans off their balance sheets altogether. However, selling distressed assets is not an easy project. I asked Piers Harben from the European Banking Authority why the market in NPLs is so weak.
At the moment, we've got what we call market imperfections, market failures in the secondary market for NPLs. And I'll highlight two. The first is information asymmetry. That means that the buyers don't really know what they're getting. And so that makes it very difficult for any buyers to come into that market. So you don't have a clearing price on the NPLs. And the second, because of this, is what we call an intertemporal pricing problem, which means the price today is probably much lower than the price in the future when we fix those market failures, which means no one wants to sell today. So we're stuck. So these NPLs are stuck in the system. We can't move them on. And we should try and address those issues around information asymmetry and intertemporal pricing problem.
One way to address these market failures is through the creation of so-called bad banks, often known as asset management companies. These take control of a bank's NPLs and manage the workout process. They free the main bank to return to lending activities while recovering maximum value from the distressed assets. They then look for private investment and eventually sell the assets on. Banks themselves can set up these asset management companies, but there is often significant state involvement. Sweden made use of bad banks in the early 90s to great effect, and several countries set up bad banks during the recent financial crisis, including Spain, Germany, and Ireland. The European Banking Authority and the ECB have both suggested a European-level bad bank. Piers Harben gave some reasons why a European approach to asset management companies, AMCs, might be more effective.
The point of a European approach, and it could either be a single European AMC or it could even be a blueprint for national AMCs, but is the following. Firstly, simplicity. It's incredibly complex out there. We're seeing a plethora of different approaches. If we had just one approach to AMCs, there'd be clarity on how it interacts with state aid rules, and there would be clarity for investors on what they're getting. Secondly, it could provide that sort of, I think, critical mass that you would need to get this market moving, and importantly would be able to provide consistent data. So whether there's one or a series of similar AMCs, if they all had the same data requirements, then as an investor, wherever you went, you knew what kind of data you would be getting. Thirdly, I think if we took a European initiative, because people would understand it, the funding, because often you put in state money and then that attracts in private funding, funding would be much cheaper. People would get it, so it's much simpler, there's comparability, and you get cheaper funding from doing it at an EU level and create that critical mass to overcome market failures.
Bruegel's Alexander Lehmann supports this idea with a few important caveats.
I think everyone who has proposed such a structure recognizes this needs to be within the framework we have in Europe for bank resolution and for state aid towards the financial sector, and that there should not be a mutualization of the legacy assets that countries in the Eurozone in particular have built up as the legacy of the crisis.
Europe's NPL burden is not a simple issue. As we've heard, there are good reasons why both banks and borrowers need to be released from these relationships. But a loan that isn't paid back is always a loss for someone, so who should take the hit? Maria de Mertzis sees no easy answer to this central question, who should pay?
The current position we're in is not an easy one, simply because it's not obvious that the banks should take the hit, and it's not equally not obvious that the debtors should be the ones that should take the hit. And then is, of course, that you know there is the public money that comes in. Should the public take that hit for the sake of simply regenerating the economy? It's a legitimate question, but it's not an easy question. What is the best way of encouraging entrepreneurship? Right. I mean, if that is the objective, how do you do that? And I think there we need to be a little bit careful, because if a bank, a creditor, knows that in the event of an insolvency, of a bankruptcy, they're not going to get their money back, they will be very reluctant to lend money out in the first place. And that is an important constraint. This is why when you start designing systems of insolvency or bankruptcy, you need to do something called protect creditors' rights. That's exactly what this is. Otherwise, credit is not created. And Europe relies on credit to grow. On the other hand, you need to balance that argument against the argument of giving people a second chance, releasing them from unproductive activities, and creating a sort of a fertile environment for entrepreneurship. And there are different ways of looking at it, and cultural attitudes play a huge role here. They should not be underestimated. In the context of Europe, there needs to be also this extra dimension of trying to have predictability across borders. So the element of some degree of harmonization between countries needs also to be addressed. And once that conversation starts, then the question is, well, what should we converge to? What should we harmonize towards? And I think we are, in any case, we are shifting more in the direction of trying to release bad debtors quicker than we have done in the past. So that, I think, is the direction we're taking, but, you know, we have to be careful of what this might cost us in terms of future new credit.
And that brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening to The Sound of Economics. If you're interested in more Bruegel work on European banking, there is a range of blogs and papers by Alexander, Maria and others available on our website at www.bruegel.org. I hope you'll join us again for The Sound of Economics. Until next time.